Hello, thank you for downloading this podcast of the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. We hope you enjoy listening to this. For more information about our programs, please visit www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.
Proceedings move along. I have the pleasure of introducing our two speakers, veritable experts on the topic of media bias and Russian foreign policy. So in person with us today, we have Dr. Donald Jensen, who is a senior advisor for Russia and Eurasia and Europe at the US Institute of Peace in Washington, DC. Dr. Jensen is also an academic teaching at Johns Hopkins University in the United States. Donald is a retired U.S. diplomat. He was in Moscow when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, and he was one of the very first people, one of the very first U.S. diplomats to visit Soviet missile bases in the late 1980s as part of the newly implemented arms control agreements between the Soviet Union and the United States. In short, Dr. Jensen has been observing, participating in, and studying issues relating to Russian foreign policy for many decades, and as such as an expert on this topic. Later on, he worked for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty in Europe, and as I said, is currently based in Washington, D.C. Joining us via Zoom from New York, there we go, is Professor Josh Tucker, who is a professor of politics at NYU's campus in New York. Dr. Tucker is also the co-director of the Center for Social Media at NYU in New York, and he is also the director of the Jordan Center for the Advanced Study of Russia. Dr. Tucker is an expert on mass political behavior in Eastern Europe, and most recently, over the past decade or so, has been working on issues relating to social media. Recently, Dr. Tucker has co-edited a book titled Social Media and Democracy, The State of the Field and Prospects for Reform. So hopefully I gave you a bit of a sense that these two gentlemen are experts in this area. Let me briefly talk about the format for tonight's event. So we will start with some remarks by the two participants. First, Dr. Jensen and Dr. Tucker, who will give us a bit of a sense for the evolution of Russian foreign policy as it relates to the issue of misinformation and the use of misinformation to persuade in different parts of the world, but notably in Ukraine and Eastern Europe. They will speak for about 15 minutes each, and then I will start the conversation off with some questions that I've put together just to get things going a little bit on the set of issues, and then we will open it up to the floor for a general Q&A and a general discussion, and so we would very much welcome questions from you. So please, as you listen to our speakers, see if you can, engage perhaps. So if anything is of interest to you or unclear, please feel free to ask in the Q&A. Let me remind you all, this goes without saying, of course, but this is a university. This is intended to be an academic conversation. These are people who are going to be sharing their research with us. They'll be talking about definitions and about evidence-based analysis. So in the Q&A, it would be helpful if we restrict the Q&A to actual questions as opposed to comments or statements of opinion. Just given the forum that we're in today. So please be mindful of that. And so without further ado, I think we're ready for Donald to give his remarks.
Thank you. If I wasn't here live, people would think I'm a creature of artificial intelligence. So thank you for having me. I'm in my spare time a professor at Johns Hopkins. I teach Russian foreign policy, and not a day goes by, it seems, when a student doesn't ask me about Russian disinformation. And it usually is a question of narratives, Russians do 18 narratives in Moldova or this in the Ukraine war, and so forth and so forth. But I want to approach the problem of disinformation and global warfare from a different angle in my remarks here. In particular, I want to put it in a broader policy context about what the Russians do, why they do it, and what difference does it make that they do it. My professor in graduate school, on my first day there, hauled me into his office and said, well, Don, we don't do hypothesis testing here. We do landscape exploring. And I want to explore the Russian disinformation topography a little bit and answer any questions you might have. I should also say, and I, having worked at Radio Free Europe for a long time after the State Department, I something I've long paid attention to. So I'm going to go through a series of questions I want to ask. I don't really have good answers, but I want to ask some questions for all of us to think about it when we read the article in the New York Times tomorrow or the Washington Post about this problem. First of all, this is not new in many ways. The Kremlin during the Cold War practiced Russian disinformation, although it wasn't called that so much then. It was called propaganda from during the Cold War. But a number of things happened beginning about 2005, which got us to the situation we were today. First, the Kremlin and Putin started to flex their muscles after a period of relative chaos in the 90s that Russia would be a great power. Russia, at the same time, reorganized all their information and influence operations in 2005 and 2006. You remember Izvestia, you remember TASS, you remember all these news services that Russia rethought through. And importantly, it went in parallel with military reform, the talk in the Kremlin ideology about the Russian world and so forth. So this information track we've been talking about so much started then. It didn't start in 2014. It was 2014 is when it was deployed for the first time in all those narratives and other things that we all talked about when we saw the first phase of the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2014. The Little Green Men, the Crimea was Russian, that it's an anti-Semitic regime, that it's neo-Nazi, stuff that has, in many ways, continued to today. But from 2005 onward, what you see is a series of very clever Russian adaptations to the media environment. It's important to keep that in mind. Shortwave became FM, became TV. This is when RT and Sputnik began to come into play, became the internet, became artificial intelligence. The Russians have very carefully had adapted their technology for spreading their messages as technological developments warrant. And how many people here have not read an artificial intelligence article in the last month? I'm sure nobody here. Everybody has. But we need to keep a couple things in mind. First of all, this is part of a Russian arsenal of foreign policy weapons, this being information operations. Russia doesn't just do information warfare. They look at a country like Georgia or Ukraine or Africa, Latin America. They pick out a series of weapons of which information operations are largely frequently used, but not exclusively, but as well as using cultural influences, money, bribery, the Wagner Group. All of these things are adjusted to suit the target, undermine the target that the Kremlin has in its crosshairs. So it's very, very important not to look at information warfare as anything other than what it is, warfare. And warfare has many dimensions, as the military would say, not always kinetic. As interesting as AI is, there are other things going on. And if you want to know what's going on, just take a look at the YouTube of Channel One, the Russian state television, and see the kind of nonsense they put out there, often to witting audiences. So number one is the information operations are one weapon among many. And it's important to keep that in mind, because as the Russians run into a deadlock on one thing, they will switch to another. Relatedly, they're very good about picking out their audience. They pick out the Venezuelan audience is different than the Estonian audience. In the Estonian audience, the messaging has to do with a particular policy goal. In Estonia, Brussels doesn't take you seriously as a NATO member, or to the Russian minority there, you guys are second-class citizens. That stuff is very traceable to different kinds of messaging, and that messaging tends to take place on different platforms, they say. RT, Sputnik, and increasingly social media, in particular social media, where it's often very effective. I looked before coming here down from the hotel what RT in the Muslim world is with their ratings, and they're actually pretty high. But what do the Russians do? A lot of their messaging is put on Facebook. They will have attractive pictures, colorful pictures, have a Russian message behind it in the picture, and people, young people who don't know any better, will then click on that. Okay, so this is an arsenal of operations. These are targeted themes. These are targeted campaigns. But every country is different. Leonid is going to Georgia soon. The Georgia messaging, look at it, is very different from the other. It's not just one size fits all. And this is part of the effectiveness, if it's effective, of Russian information operations. Now, second or third, we don't really have a very good sense of how the Russians do this. You think of it as a little troll farm in the middle of the woods in a swamp, but actually, their operations are becoming increasingly sophisticated. I shared with Leonid before the show this article by Catherine Belton in the Washington Times from February 16th. Quoting East European intelligence sources, it goes into explicit detail about how they do it, how the Russians oversee it, how the presidential administration monitors results. This kind of thing is golden because no one ever talks about this. All we see are the 58 messages to Ukraine. Not that that's not important, but again, it's a to use that awful word, holistic. It's a holistic operation. It's war. And for Russians, kinetic or non-kinetic warfare is still war, and the West is the enemy. But there's a problem here, which is to say, what is the impact of all of this? And this is something that large organizations like the Global Engagement Center in Washington pay a lot of attention to, but there's no clear answer. What difference does it make that all of this stuff goes out there? When I worked at RFE, there was a difference between listenership and viewership. So do people watch RT for the sports results or for the earthquakes they cover, or for the Kremlin messaging? It's not really very clear at all. And sometimes you can see an impact that it has. Sometimes you can see that it doesn't. And this is one of the greatest methodological challenges when you're looking at Russian influence operations. How do you measure influence? Well, almost every reason is pretty imprecise. If you look at RT or Channel 1, they have a lot of people who watch it, but what difference does it make that people watch it? Well, clearly, I think everybody probably in the room here would agree that it does. But measuring it enough to make sound policy is much, much more difficult. Now, one way that's clear is that people think about issues differently because of Kremlin information propaganda. For example, the Little Green Man I mentioned, the anti-Semitism in Ukraine, alleged. None of that exists. There was a Russian invasion. It wasn't Little Green Men. Donbass voted overwhelmingly to secede from the Soviet Union, and they were in 91. There was no secessionist movement to speak of in Donbass at all. But the Russians kept saying that there was. There are no anti-Semitism. In fact, I saw a poll about a year ago that Ukraine has one of the lowest instances of anti-Semitism of any European country. So all of this sticks in people's minds. It sticks in people's minds. And thus, when you know nothing about a country, and many people in Washington knew nothing about Ukraine or Georgia or Moldova, those first impressions matter a lot. Well, how about the anti-Semitism? Well, there's no anti-Semitism. Well, I heard somewhere that there is. That kind of thing happens again and again and again. And it's maddening from the point of view of a researcher like myself to not have a more tangible graph about what is going on. Where does it matter? In some cases, it's very clear. It matters on the battlefield when artificial intelligence is used to power those drones, when artificial intelligence is used by Russia to do creative lying where Zelensky is fighting with Zelensky or something like that. That stuff is apparently effective. But notice how it's done in the context of a multidimensional competition, multidimensional kind of warfare. It tends not to exist alone. But when you don't know anything about Ukraine and you're sitting in a think tank in D.C. in 2014 and you hear there's anti-Semitism, well, there must be. Or you see versions of history that are absolutely ridiculous. There was a meme a couple weeks ago after Putin's interview with Putin said something and about Moscow and Vladimir Prince Vladimir and all that stuff. Well, Moscow was a swamp. And the Ukrainians sent around a picture of Moscow over the centuries. It was a swamp in the woods, a swamp in the woods, and the swamp in the woods. And the corresponding picture was all these beautiful cathedrals in Kiev. So what's my point? There, you can even weaponize history with disinformation. And that's what the Kremlin has done. And every country, especially Russia, but every country, has their myths about its origins, and that's what the Kremlin can take advantage of. If you don't know about a subject, you're going to believe the first or second thing you hear about it. Now, I think I'm at my limit of time, but I would say we've got to take any questions about this. So be critical. The policy challenges in responding to this are immense. The ambassador's here, and she knows better than I do. But we have to keep trying. We have to be as flexible as the Russians are. Because if you say, well, Lavrov said this yesterday, and he said this the day before yesterday, and they're contradictory, it doesn't matter. What matters is undermining confidence in the West, in Ukraine. What matters is causing divisions in the allies. What matters is whatever spaghetti the Kremlin throws against the wall, what sticks. It doesn't have to be consistent with the spaghetti that yesterday they threw in the wall, which also sucks. So be careful, be critical. And the war, this war, this dimension of the war is going to go on, I think, for quite a long time. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Great. Thank you so much, Don, for your thoughts. I think we're now ready for comments from Josh Tucker, who will be taking us in a slightly different direction, talking about social media, I think, specifically, as far as I understand. Josh, go ahead. Josh, we cannot hear you. We see your presentation, but we cannot hear you.
Great. Yeah.
There you go. We can hear you now.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much, Leo. Thanks for the invitation for everyone to be here today. Thanks for including me in this. I'm going to talk to you today about research that we've done in these areas around bots, trolls, and foreign influence campaigns. So what I'm going to do in this particular presentation is I'm going to first introduce a few terms. Then I'm going to talk about goals of disinformation campaigns. Then I'm going to show you research that we did about Russian bots in Russian domestic politics. And then finally, I'll show you a bunch of research we did at the Center for Social Media and Politics about Russian trolls in the 2016 U.S. elections. And that'll be divided between a quick overview into what these trolls on Twitter were doing, and then some research that we have, very apropos what Donald just said, about exposure and impact. And apropos Donald's comment, I did have a picture in here beforehand. You created with generative AI of a potential troll factory, exactly as the stereotype of you had of it. Those of you who are familiar with Soviet history will recognize the image on the top here. So I want to introduce you to three terms that are useful for understanding these kind of influence campaigns. One is bots. Bots refers to accounts that post information online based on automated algorithms. And so this means it's information that's being produced by computer programs, essentially. And now, more recently, we've had this development where these bots can actually interact with chatbots. So this could be, in the earlier days, this was automated information that was sort of drawn from pre-specified information, now it can involve chatbots. When we refer to trolls, however, we're talking about humans who post information online, but with a disguised identity. So these are humans who post information online but pretending to be someone else, and I'll show you in 1 second. And then cyborgs, which I'm not going to talk about today, are mixtures of human are accounts that are mixtures of human and automated account posting. So this is an example of a Russian IRA troll from the 2016 election. You will notice it doesn't look very Russian. It is disguising itself as an American who is a big supporter of Second Amendment gun rights in the country. This was one particular IRA troll, just to give you a sense of what they look like. All right, so what are the goals of disinformation campaigns? Donald's already talked about this quite a bit, but I think one of the things that we want to, when we focus on foreign influence campaigns, we think about sort of two sets of goals. One set of goals is you could intervene in order to help particular political actors in that country. That was when Donald was talking about the targets of these things. But we also think about foreign influence campaigns as overall casting doubt on the integrity of a target country. So you can think about things intended to cast doubt on democracy generally, on elections generally, on judicial impartiality, on nonpartisan press, and even on specific election outcomes. And of course, these goals can overlap. You can be trying to cast doubt on the process while at the same time that you're also trying to help particular political actors. All right. So what do we know about Russian bots? One of our claims to fame at the Center for Social Media and Politics is we were researching Russian bots before anyone had heard of Russian bots because we were interested in what they were doing in Russian domestic politics. For those of you who are interested, I'm happy to talk much more about this in question and answer. But one of the first big things we did was we built up automated methods combined with humans in the loop to find and identify and eventually classify Twitter accounts as bots or humans in a kind of bespoke manner. The most recent paper that we produced from this was looking at Russian behavior of Russian bots in domestic politics, where we looked at the interaction between Russian bots and how they were used in response to protest. And they're essentially, what's interesting, if you've never kind of looked at this literature before, when you think about the way that online actors can engage with domestic populations, there's a number of different ways that they can be used. One of which is called flooding. In which case you're trying to, when there's going to be a protest, you're trying to increase the amount of information online so people are less likely to see information about the protest. There's a few different ways you could do that. You can do that with volume, with the total number of tweets from these bots going up. You can also do this with what we call retweet diversity, when you suddenly start trying to talk about lots of different topics online to distract from what the opposition is trying to do. On the flip side, though, building on research that comes from China, from Molly Roberts, Jen Pan, and Gary King, we also learned that another thing that bots do is just what's called cheerleading, which is instead of talking about just sort of putting volume up there generally, you sort of put out very positive content about your own candidate, the person on your side. And then there's the sort of more traditional way we might think about this, which is what we call negative campaigning. So in our case, we were looking at whether the tweets about Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader at the time we were running the study, would go up. We looked at in the paper where we did this study, we looked at whether bots were used in response to offline protests to try to demobilize offline protests, or if they were used in response to online protests, where things were happening online, when there was a surge of activity from opposition leaders online. What we found was that actually, in regard to both offline and online protests, we did see Russian bots that we had identified tweeting much more on the days of protest, although this effect was, as you can see here, is stronger among when there's online protests as opposed to offline protests. We saw the same thing for retweet diversity. When we look at cheerleading happens very strongly in response to when there's online opposition activity, but we don't see much of an effect for it for offline protests. And then this negative campaigning is the only thing where you kind of target the opposition leader. We see a very slight increase on this when there's online protests, but we see a sort of larger increase when on days of actual protest. So our findings here was that Russian pro-government bots were used for both online agenda control and offline demobilization. And we found that these effects were especially pronounced on days of increased online opposition activity. And negative campaigning is the only strategy employed more during protests than on days of increased online opposition activity. And if you want to see more about this research, it was published in the American Political Science Review in 2022. All right, so what do we know about the Russian IRA when Russians use these kind of digital weapons on the offense in the foreign interference, which we're talking more about here today. So I want to begin by showing you a little bit about what they did. So this is famously the Russian Internet Research Agency, where in 2016, most of the activity on Twitter, which is what I'm going to be talking about here for the rest of the talk, as well as other platforms, and I'm going to focus on what they did on Twitter because we know more about it, was run out of in St. Petersburg. And there was a lot of, because Twitter actually released this information first to the US government and then to academic researchers, we were able to study and learn a lot about what these trolls were actually doing. So there was some great research that looked at the text of the posts, as well as the networks in which they were embedded. And we learned about this research that there were some left-leaning trolls, there were right-leaning trolls, and that they were embedding themselves in networks in an attempt to sort of increase polarization. We have the report of the U.S. Intelligence Committee in the Senate, which concluded that basically these trolls were trying to harm Clinton's chance in the 2000 election and increase Trump's chance of winning in the 2016 election, in addition to sowing this polarization. All right, so what we've learned about troll behavior at the NYU Center for Social Media and Politics, here what we did was we did something slightly different. We focused on the links shared by IRA troll accounts on Twitter and on Reddit, looking at links to news sources and links to YouTube videos. So what do we learn? Interestingly enough, you would think about foreign actors as sharing sort of deceptive information, but it actually turned out what these trolls were doing, especially originally, was they were sharing lots of links to local news media in the US, as opposed to, and we didn't put these classifications together, but as opposed to what other researchers had called junk media, and even as opposed to national media. We also saw that over the course of the campaign, when the trolls sort of first started appearing in early 2015, the conservative accounts started sharing more and more conservative content. The liberal accounts started sharing slightly more liberal content. But you can see almost in the beginning, these accounts were sharing sort of very similar level content. Very interestingly, we found what the Senate report had talked about more generally in terms of the fact that there were trolls, or what the earlier research looking at the text of these things had looked at, we found that there were trolls that were sharing links to liberal news sources, that were sharing to moderate news sources and to conservative news sources, and that this was, you know, relatively balanced across liberal, moderate, and conservative. Although, to be clear, when we say they were sharing links to liberal news sources, it doesn't mean they were sharing pro-Clinton news stories there. You can have a link in a liberal news source which is talking about a crime committed by immigrants or something like that. However, what is really interesting, when we started looking at the links that they were sharing to YouTube, this kind of distinction disappeared. And we saw overwhelmingly they were sharing links to conservative YouTube videos. And it's even slightly more clever. If you look in this figure that we've got here, what you can see is that on the x-axis, we've got the sort of ideology of the links that were being shared, or to the sources that we're sharing. And on the y-axis, we have the mean YouTube channel ideology. Each one of these circles is a different troll account. And as you would expect from the existing studies showing there were these left-wing trolls and right-wing trolls, they kind of line up along the regression line that we show here, this red line, and generally you're either producing more conservative content or more liberal content. However, there's a subset of trolls in the northwest corner here of this figure that was sharing links to liberal news sources, but also sharing links to conservative YouTube videos. So if you kind of throw all this together, what you see is a somewhat, going on with Donald said, some degree of sophistication in what these accounts were trying to do. You had them starting off more moderate, then sharing increasingly liberal or conservative content. And you had this pattern where there were some of these trolls that were potentially trying to lure people in by sharing links to more liberal news sources, but then also serving them up more conservative YouTube videos. Okay, so as Donald said, though, what we often really want to know about this is like, okay, so what's happening when this stuff goes out there in the world? And while there was a flurry of research because of this Twitter data that was publicly shared, and there was a flurry of research about what these trolls were doing, we actually knew very little about what was happening in the sense of who was being exposed to them and what was the potential impact of this exposure. So we have an idea of what the goals were, but what was actually going on? Well, we realized, unfortunately, a little later than I would have liked, that at the Center for Social Media and Politics, we actually had data that would allow us to assess this. And the reason was because in the 2016 US elections, we had fielded what's known as a panel survey. We talked to the same people in April of 2016, again in October of 2016, and then again after the election to get their vote choice. And for about 1,500 of these people, we had their Twitter handles. And because Twitter data was publicly available, once we had their Twitter data, we could actually find out every single person they were following. And then we went and collected every tweet from every person that these folks were following, these 1,500 people. And at that point in time, this was before TikTok, the platforms were using what were called, Twitter was using what was called a reverse chronological feed. So you just saw the tweets coming in that had were posted by the people you followed, what based on what was the most recent tweet they had done. So what we were able to do was basically observe the information environment on Twitter of all 1,500 of our respondents. We knew every tweet to what they could have been exposed over the entire course of this particular campaign. Now, this was a mammoth undertaking, and it eventually ended up collecting 1.2 billion tweets, that's B with a billion, to try to understand what to characterize this information environment of these 1,500 respondents. But crucially, that's then let us know for every one of these respondents what tweets from Russian trolls they were exposed to, and then crucially importantly, what retweets of Russian trolls. So if they followed someone who then retweeted a tweet by a Russian troll. So the data allows us to look at exposure, and we can link it to outcomes, which is Donald's point about influence. All right, so this is our major figure on exposure. And if what we look at the top figure of this, you see that over the course of the campaign, our people in our panel were exposed to, on average, about four or five tweets from Russian trolls in a given day. And that spikes on election day to about an average of 14 tweets. Now, that sounds like a lot every day. That sounds like these things might be actually very prevalent out there. But if you look at panel B here, what you see is this is a logarithmic scale on the x-axis that refers to the percentage of survey respondents who accounted for the percentage of exposures on the y-axis. And what you see from this chart is that 1% of our panel, 15 people, accounted for 75% of these overall exposures. This is a pattern we see over and over again on the internet. We call it a power law, where small numbers of people are having large, whatever it is we're studying, and large numbers of people are having almost nothing of it. And as you'll see here, that when we get to 10% of our respondents, they account for 99% of these exposures. So 90% of our respondents are getting almost no exposure to these trolls at all. We also find that the amount of content that is being produced by the exposure to content from Russian trolls is just absolutely dwarfed by the amount of content people are getting from other sources about elections. You see politicians here, and then it's an order of magnitude higher from the news media. This chart on the lower right here is one of my favorite I've ever had in a paper because, of course, the median number of posts seen by anyone was zero in this because 90% of our sample wasn't seeing any of these at all. We're also, because we connected this to survey data, we were also able to look at who were the people getting exposed. And as you would expect, it was strong Republicans and it was males. So pulling all these things together, and I wasn't going to show this, so I'm going to take an extra 30 seconds here, Leo, over time, because Donald brought this up at the end. But the other thing that we're able to do with this paper is that because we have this panel data, we can then look and see, is there any relationship between being exposed to more of these tweets and changing your opinion on issue areas or your vote preferences? Now, this isn't causal because it's not an experiment, but it would be what you would think if these were having an effect. At the bare minimum, you would expect people who are exposed to more of these tweets to have changed. And what we find is, being exposed to these tweets had no impact on polarization, and it had no impact. Not impact is the wrong word, but it has no relationship to polarization, no relationship to changing your vote. So what do we know now about this internet-based campaign here? We know there was non-trivial exposure in 2016, but it was heavily concentrated and among those most likely to support Trump. We know there was orders of magnitude more exposure to media and politicians, and now, maybe not surprisingly, there was no systematic relationship to issue polarization, no systematic relationship to vote choice. So I'll leave you with where Donald left you as well, which is the point that we both need to know systematically what is happening in these campaigns, which is hard enough, But we also really need to think about what the impact of these campaigns are, which is even harder thing to study. And I think as we continue to think about this, this is something we want to make sure that we're doing. So thank you very much for inviting. I'm really looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you very much, Josh. So now we're going to, I've prepared some questions that I'm now going to share with our speakers, and we'll have just a few minutes where I'll try to put in place some foundations for what we're talking about when we talk about misinformation, and then we'll open it up to questions and answers, to questions from the floor. So first, I wanted to ask you a very basic question. What do we mean by misinformation? So how would you define misinformation? And what's, I think, quite interesting in these presentations is that different definitions of misinformation came up. We can think of misinformation as something that a foreign government states without attributing this to themselves. So they don't say, we, the Russian government, think X, but rather they say X is a fact, and so there is lack of attribution. Is that misinformation? Or a foreign government can lie through its public officials or through proxies, sometimes proxies that don't identify themselves as being affiliated with any government. And then there is something that Josh was showing us, which is simply intent to wreak havoc or intent to spread political chaos, if you like, through information that is not really directed for any specific goal other than to create confusion in the minds of individuals in a given country. And so are all of these three things, do they all fall under the definition of misinformation as you understand it? Or would you define misinformation in some other way? And Josh, let's perhaps start with you.
Thanks, Leo. So I actually led a great team of people that wrote this report for the Hewlett Foundation called Social Media, Political Polarization, and Misinformation. And it kind of grew into the book that you mentioned during the introduction, that the book was a sort of longer version of it. And in that, we adopted this definition that actually had been put out by Kelly Bourne, who was a program officer at the Hewlett Foundation. And this is how I would define it. So, and I think it's a great, I want to just say, it's a great question to ask, because this is one of the concerns in the field, is after this field has emerged for the last 8 years, do we have different people writing different research with different definitions for things? So this is how I think about it. Misinformation is information that's factually correct. Factually incorrect, right? So that's the definition of misinformation. One can share misinformation. If one shares misinformation but doesn't know that it's factually incorrect, that's sharing misinformation. Disinformation is when you are deliberately sharing information that you know is not correct. Hyperpartisanship is when you share correct information, but you do so in a way so as to obscure this, essentially the meaning, or even if it's not to obscure the meaning, it's to sort of layer on to it a sort of much more partisan element to it, right? So you could imagine that you have like three things here you consider, right? Like you're reporting on the unemployment rate. If the unemployment rate is 3.5%, if you heard it was 4%, you say it's 4%, you're spreading misinformation because it's not right. If you know it's 3.5% and you say it's 4%, you're spreading disinformation. If you write a headline that says horrendous Biden administration presides over regime where unemployment hits 3.5%, not misinformation, right? But it is in that case you're reporting something that's true, but you're doing it in this kind of hyperpartisan manner. Now, foreign influence campaigns, which is what we're talking about here, and I think this is a really crucial point, foreign influence campaigns can use disinformation, they can spread hyperpartisan information, but they can also use true information, right? Well, that was one of the most interesting things when we started looking at these links in the first paper that we put out, the Ports report we put about this, was that really that these trolls were sharing, you know, we went into this thinking, okay, they're Russian trolls. This was a disinformation campaign. They're going to be sharing misinformation. Like, that kind of makes sense in your head. And then we found that there were all these troll accounts that were just sharing links to local news sources. And what's been speculated about that afterwards, I mean, there's a couple different reasons that might be the case. One is, it might just have been easier and it was satisfying, and people were, if we think about this in the case of people going to work every day and having to do so many posts, and this was just a simple thing they could do. But it might have been more strategic. Like, one of the arguments we've heard is that some of these accounts were trying to build up trust over the time in the lead up into the election. And so that after the election, when Donald Trump lost the election, those accounts could then claim that it was fraudulent, right? That didn't happen. Donald Trump didn't lose the election. And so we'll never know if that was what the plan was. But I think it's super important to understand that these information campaigns can include the truth. It can include things that are linking to trust building. It can include all sorts of different things. So we want to be careful to just assume, to not to make this assumption that just because it's a foreign influence campaign, it's only going to be sharing misinformation. And conversely, that just because true news is being shared doesn't mean it's part of one of these larger campaigns that Donald's been describing.
So just to quickly follow up, when it comes to foreign influence campaigns, is this about who is sharing? So if it's Russian government agents and they purport to be someone else, is that the definition of a foreign influence campaign, irrespective of what information they're actually sharing?
I mean, that's a great question also. I think when we talk about foreign influence campaigns, we can again think, and maybe Donald will want to speak to this as well, we can again think of a continuum of this, right? Like, and when I always think about actors that are involved in these kind of influence campaigns, like, we can think about this in an incredibly sort of, you know, benign way. We can think of this as Russian government. I think about it, you know, if you think about it in the course of domestic politics, you're the Russian government, you're trying to control the discussion online. There are incredibly benign ways that we would think about this, right? Russian government, I have a picture of Medvedev when he's at Twitter headquarters and tweeting out, you know, at the Pervy tweet, right? Like, this is my first tweet. And we, you know, and in a sense, like, that was the sort of promise of e-government and the internet. It was going to bring government officials closer to people and enhance, you know, accountability in this regard and enhance communications. So you can think about influence being in that line. Then you can think about this as being people who are identifying themselves as real people, but they're not identifying themselves as their affiliation with this overall campaign. Then you can think about this as people who are not identifying themselves as real people, who are identifying themselves as fake people, like these trolls were, and being part of a campaign. Then you can think about accounts that aren't people, they're bots or they're chat bots, and they're not identifying themselves as who they are and being parts of this campaign. And look, we've always thought, I mean, and Donald, you know, we've always thought public diplomacy is a very legitimate action for states. So when we think about influence campaigns, and we, you know, if we use the term public diplomacy, that sounds good. If we use the term foreign influence campaigns, that sounds bad. So the question is, from a positive perspective, from us as scholars, we want to understand these different components and know how to look for them and think about how they fit together. From a normative conception, I think we have to begin to think about, like, what do we think is legitimate on the basis of states? I think everyone would agree the trolls, where you're pretending to be, you're actually a you know, a 24-year-old college graduate in St. Petersburg, you're pretending to be an ex-Navy SEAL in Tennessee, and you're trying to influence the outcome of the U.S. elections, that there's something nefarious about that, right? Public diplomacy, where people say that, you know, the U.S. model of government is a shining beacon on the hill, and we're going to talk about why, you know, people might want to emulate that. I think people would think that's less. I mean, some people might think that's nefarious too, but, like, people might think that that's less. So I think it's a question of gradation. But I'm super interested to hear Donald's take on that as well.
Don,
I agree with your definition of what disinformation is, but I want to make two points we've skated around a couple times. Number one is the creation of chaos for strategic advantage. That's what the Russians want to do. They're fighting above their weight, if you're a boxing fan, and so they know that declining poll ratings for Zelensky or for Zelensky, whoever, that's what they want to do. They don't have to have a coherent strategy on many of these issues. It's good enough to cause trouble. I mentioned the famous spaghetti image. But one of the interesting things about the Belton article, and it, I highly recommend reading it, at one of the versions of the article has the actual photo of the dashboard that Kirienko and the presidential administration used to rate how effective they were. Zelensky's rating going down, increased perception of tension between Zelensky and Zelensky. They actually have boxes to check. Now, given how bad their analytical forecasting was before the war. I find this is the kind of thing you might sell to your superior in the presidential administration, hoping it looks pretty good, but they actually pay attention to that kind of thing. So the chaos creation and then measuring the chaos creation seem to be two sides of the same coin.
So following up on that, the next question is about what is new about misinformation and disinformation campaigns today. Propaganda and the use of propaganda by governments is not something that is new. This is something that has been around perhaps for as long as governments have been around, and we certainly know for a fact that there has been intelligence and counterintelligence campaigns certainly over the course of the 20th century, going back all the way to the First, and especially the Second World War. And so is there something different, substantively different, about the use of misinformation and disinformation today from the way propaganda campaigns were waged over the course of the 20th century? And if there is a difference, so we're in a substantively different era now with regards to the use of misinformation, then what is it? What makes today a different moment from what we had over the course of the past 100 years? So, Don, let's start with you.
Continuity versus change is our professorial way of fudging this stuff. I would say a couple of things are different. Number one is the technology is far more sophisticated. If you go back and look at some of the books on the Cold War, you see it's nowhere. It was crude and really kind of ham-handed. Now it's much more sophisticated and capable of adapting. And the second is I think the pervasiveness of the messaging. Everybody in Russia who's under the age of 30, and most people get their news from social media, so there's no other alternatives. And so it's pervasiveness horizontally and also the ability to use it in more sophisticated ways, which allows you to change your message in midstream sometime. Can I add a footnote right here, which is to say, or we can, the issue of military bloggers and Telegram channels becomes very interesting. These devices that Josh and I have talked about are also mechanisms of control, and they're mechanism of elite expression of competition. So one could argue that Putin might adapt a certain information policy to affect the domestic audience or to affect the popular. I hate when people quote their own articles, but I wrote something on military blogging last August, which is to say these elite nodes of power and influence in the KGB or the presidential administration or some wise guy, teenager in his garage, they start to comment on the war or Putin, and the Kremlin may do something like tighten the internet, in fact they do, to keep a better control over the population, and that's the primary goal. It's not to destabilize Italy. And if you look at what's happened in the general trend on internet in Russia, which is a greater Kremlin control, this Telegram issue was one of the last channels of relatively free expression. And they were blasting Putin for, why aren't you winning? Why aren't you killing more Ukrainians? Forgive me. And Putin cracked down. So it's also driven by domestic concerns.
Josh, do you have something to add to this? How is misinformation today different from the way it was 50 years ago?
Yeah. Again, I think it's a crucial question, and I think we want to keep an eye on the many ways it's not different, because we learned a lot over, you know, over history that we can apply here. But let me point to two crucial ways, and this is how I kind of think about it. One is that what social media does is it comes along and it dramatically reduces the cost of spreading information, right? Maybe not as much for foreign governments, but in general, if you think about pre-social media era, if you wanted to get news out to people, right, either you had to get on a television program, you had to get a newspaper to publish what you're doing, you had to reach out to people personally, right? Like, think about trying to organize a protest, put flyers up around your town. All of a sudden, what social media does is it creates this almost cost-free way for us to spread information. And as these platforms consolidate and we get more and more people on a smaller and smaller number of platforms, you can spread this information to just really, really large numbers of people. You still, however, though, had to produce that information, right? And there are costs associated with producing information. And I think the costs associated with producing information can give us insight into like who does this. Like if we look across campaigns that are better funded, we also look across nation states. There are nation states that can put more resources to this, like Russia can. But it becomes this kind of production cost. That production cost is not going to disappear, but I would posit that generative AI is going to have an impact. It potentially has an impact on lowering the production cost of content. Now, you still need a strategy along the way Donald's talking about. You still need a sort of, you know, potential organization. But if we think about the fact that the cost of production used to be high enough to prohibit certain actors from getting involved in this in a large way, I think it's really an interesting question going forward to ask the question of how generative AI may reduce the cost of production and for what types of actors it will reduce the cost of production. And one thing, given the theme of the conversation today, that I think we really want to pay attention to here is that one cost of producing content is if you are producing the content with people who are fluent in one language and they're trying to deploy the content in a different language, there is a translation cost there. And one of the things we know about some of the stuff that came out of the early Russian attempts, these 2016 attempts, is they were clunky looking, right? You could tell they probably weren't written by a native English speaker. That's going to disappear, right? Moreover, lots of people know English, like the idea that English would be the barrier. But what these generative AI models are going to do is they're going to open up these possibilities for lots of different languages, right? Like you may not normally have a lot of people sitting around who are able to do this in other languages. And so I do think, you know, it is, again, starting with what Don said, when we think about the technology of social media reduces the cost of spread, the technology of generative AI may be reducing the cost of production.
Okay. So a quick follow-up to this. There is a risk that we're presenting social media, TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, as something that's inherently nefarious, something that's inherently being used for evil by foreign governments. But, of course, social media is just a platform. It's just a platform for disseminating information. And so you've tried to answer this question without going deeper into it. Let me invite you to say more about it. The question is, how many people does a Russian misinformation or Chinese misinformation or misinformation by any other state, how many people does it actually reach? Are the audiences for these messages, RT, so that's Russia Today, Sputnik, or even these bots or the impersonators on the American accounts? Josh, you've showed us evidence suggesting that very few people are actually being affected by this. Don has suggested in his comments that it's difficult to know, but perhaps it's many more people than we think. And so, very directly, do you feel that Russian misinformation reaches a lot of people?
I don't use that word feel in social science, but remember a few years ago when there was a story that NATO was sending 300 tanks to Ukraine. And someone actually traced the origin of the story. And actually, they were sending 300 vehicles, and they were trucks. But so one story from a garage in Sverdlovsk becomes this great disinformation thing. I don't know. I hate to say I don't know, but I don't know it replays. But I go back to the point I made at the podium that how we think about an issue is also very important. And I would put that almost immeasurable phenomenon as something where Russia has this kind of stuff, whether five people believe it or not. It's picked up by media. It's picked up, and issues are framed a certain way. And you know how the Russians like to trade in negotiations things they don't even control, like Donbass. It's the same thing. Go back to the Nazis and all these horrible influences that allegedly were in Ukraine, but weren't. If enough people who, I don't want to bash the media, if enough people who write about this online and elsewhere describe it a certain way, people start to believe it. That's all that matters. It doesn't really matter if it's a million people or 2 million people or two people, as long as a prominent Western media outlet writes about it a certain way. That's all it does. Because after all, this, as I said, this is one dimension of a multidimensional Russian influence. They do other things as well, like bribe Italian politicians and so forth. So again, I don't want to isolate the variable out of the broader context of how the Kremlin behaves.
Josh?
Yeah, thanks, Leo. Excellent question. You know, on the one hand, I want to say that what the study that I showed you here today really, really reminds us to take very seriously is that the information environment is an incredibly crowded space, right? We are constantly competing for people's attention. I showed you some data about the relative prevalence of Russian troll tweets versus media tweets who we think might be talking about politics, or politicians who we think would be talking about politics, right? But you're also competing with TikTok videos about makeup and about home renovation and about cooking, and you're competing with news, and you're competing with all these different things. The information environment is a really crowded space, and it's hard for any actor to break through, nefarious or not nefarious. So I think that we want to give us caution. And I want to be very clear that I think, you know, as an American citizen, there is you can simultaneously hold two thoughts in your head, which is that the Russian attempt to influence the outcome of the 2016 U.S. elections by putting a bunch of tweets on Twitter may have not had any impact on people changing their votes. And as a U.S. citizen, be very concerned that a foreign government is trying to interfere with your electoral process, right? And to go back to Don's point, like, one of the things we've talked about in this is, like, you know, these are multifaceted campaigns with lots of different elements to them. We don't know if this was a trial run to see how the U.S. would respond to Russian meddling in an election, because next time they might try to ramp it up and do all sorts of other things that might have been more dangerous. So I think that that's, you know, I think we want to make sure that we are, you know, that we are clear about, we can have things that are attempts to do things that, as a state, you don't want other states to be attempting to do, even if they're doing them in ham-fisted ways that don't actually end up having much of an outcome in that particular case that you're thinking about. The other thing is, I really do want to agree with Don on his point here. Like, I want to be very clear. What we were trying to do in this paper was look at the relationship between being exposed to these tweets and changing your vote. It's very hard to get people to change their vote. I can tell you who 90% of Americans are going to vote for in the 2024 election without even knowing who the candidates are. I mean, I think I know who the candidates are now, but right, like, most people are extremely fixed. And there's a difference between what we were looking at here, which was trying to say, like, okay, did these tweets have an impact on, were they related to vote choice? Were they related to people becoming more polarized? Because everyone was saying that was what's happening. That doesn't mean that but what Don's talking about is that you have these foreign influence campaigns that put out narratives, and those narratives get picked up in the media, and those narratives become stuck in the back of people's heads in a very John Zollerin type way, and people vaguely remember them when they're asked questions about this, right? So there can be all sorts of pathways that these kind of influence campaigns can have impact and can have effect. And actually, one of our newest projects that we're looking at, Don, I'm glad you brought up RT here, is we're trying to look, we're doing trying to develop automated ways to do narrative tracing across different media sources. And one of the things that motivated this, that sort of substantive question we're trying to answer, is whether or not the way that RT and Sputnik talked about Russia's invasion of Ukraine in the aftermath of the invasion, did that have an impact on how U.S. media then proceeded to talk about it, right? And it turns out to be a very technically difficult problem to get at, but we're making a lot of headway on this. And I think that becomes really, really important. And there's reasons to think that in this media environment with media sources that have lower budgets, that are not on the ground, you know, this is a kind of like second order impact of what these influence campaigns, of what these kind of propaganda efforts can be, because we can look at who's reading RT or Sputnik, right, and say, okay, that's the direct effect. But if RT and Sputnik is changing the way that other news sources that are seen by much more people are talking about, then that's even much bigger.
You've been listening to a download from the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. You'll find more information on our website, www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.